This is a war between the government and the Tamil people.
I'm not a fucking terrorist. You are the terrorist.
People are crying out for justice in this country.
If you've got to be militant to achieve your aims and your aspirations, so be it.
There's a real hypocrisy from the big corporations.
The people from below will push for real change.
This Australia is going to be shocked, and then the public will say, what the hell's going on?
Welcome to the Indie Media Show on RTRFM 92.1. My name is Raymond Grenfell. Joining me in the studio, Brahma, keeping up the positive vibes. First up, a huge thank you to Jeff for another excellent edition of On The Record. He'll be back next week at 9 a.m. But of course, you can catch On The Record every weekday here at RTRFM from 9. And also, thanks to Sam for the news. He'll be back at 12 o'clock to give you the RTRFM news updates. But on today's show, we're going to be discussing a couple of issues in depth. We're going to be talking about a proposed clearing around the Serpentine Dam. Community groups and environmentalists say that they're outraged by plans to begin logging at one of Perth's most critical sources of drinking water. The Serpentine Dam, approximately 50 k's southeast of Perth, supplies 39 gigalitres of drinking water to the metro area. But this hasn't prevented plans for a Jarrah-integrated harvesting operation within the reservoir protection zone. So we're going to be catching up with Dr. Jeff Bremen a little later in the show, who's a part of a group of locals who are trying to stop the logging of this area in our just southeast of Perth. We're also going to be catching up with Indie Media regular Alex Wisson, presenter and co-host Alex Wisson, to get a bit of a, I guess, perspective on the unfolding conflict in Ukraine, between Ukraine and Russia. Alex is someone who's been following these developments very closely, and so we're going to be hearing from him a little bit about what exactly is happening. It's a complicated situation in many respects, but I think Alex is well positioned to be able to give us a bit of an insight as to what's happening on the ground and what it means in terms of the broader geopolitical machinations. Now, many of you were perhaps thinking that native logging is coming to an end, and while that might certainly be the case in terms of some of our logging in the next year or two as the state government moves to totally transform our forest management plan, there still is a significant amount of forest being cleared. Particularly, this is the case with our Jarrah forests that are under threat from Alcoa's operations in bauxite mining, but also from clear felling from the Forest Products Commission. Most recently, an area near the Serpentine Dam has been earmarked for clearing, and a group of locals have gotten together to try and oppose this clearing that they say threatens both Perth's water supply and also just this incredibly biodiverse hotspot up around Serpentine and the Jarrah Forest there. A little earlier today, I had an opportunity to speak to Dr. Jeff Bremer. Dr. Jeff Bremer is from the Jarrahdale Forest Protectors Group, who are campaigning under the Save Our Jarrah campaign. And I started by asking Dr. Bremer exactly what was proposed around the Serpentine Dam and what kind of impact it would have on the native area.
First of all, it is true that logging in state forests has been will be stopped at the end of 2023. But in the meantime, the Forest Products Commission have their logging plan. And in December, they issued their current operations plan for 2022. And there is a block on the shores of Serpentine Dam called Serpentine 03, which was earmarked for logging in January and February this year. Letters went to residents earlier last year and also indicated that they'd be pushing roads into that block in March this year. There are plans clearly to log and take large quantities of wood from all around the state, but in particular that block is on some so far untouched forest by mining. But all to the north of Serpentine Dam, going right over to Jarrahdale and from the Serpentine National Park in the west to the Mondonox Recreation Area in the east, and all of it is claimed by Alcoa as a mining company applying to mine the whole lot. So we see this as an important area where we are seeking from the minister to stop the logging in Serpentine 03.
I'm sure many of us have spent some time around that area, around the Serpentine Dam and in the you know, sort of quite beautiful Jarrah Forest there. What is, I guess, so significant about this area and about Jarrah Forest in general as, in terms of their ecology and I guess also being close to the dam as well? There's something significant about that.
There is. I think, first of all, we should recognise that the entire northern Jarrah Forest and the forests of Western Australia have been very heavily exploited and overlogged for 150 years. So much so that even without the government's announcement, the logging industry was just about a dead duck. There was not enough, you know, wood. Secondly, that they are fragile ecologies, and the Forest Products Commission doesn't have to seek EPA approval for their environmental impact and has been operating that way for decades. Similarly, the miners do not have to get EPA approval, although Alcoa has, in this case, applied for that approval. And then finally, or two other things. Firstly, that the ecology is fragile, and what is a world biodiversity hotspot is under serious stress. There are no longer any numbats left in the Darling Range. We have quokkas in the Darling Range, which are threatened species. Charitjas or native cats are also a threatened species. And I could go on, cockatoos, etc. Finally, there is a critically endangered species, which is the western ringtailed possums. I'd say, sadly, they're all dead in the Darling Range, and their populations have plummeted across Western Australia by 90%. Mm. So in those areas, we don't really want to see more habitat destruction, and that's probably our main case.
Totally. I will get on to asking about Alcoa and the impacts of mining in a moment, but I guess just looking at Forest Products Commission and clear felling and logging in these areas, many of our listeners might not be aware that a lot of the actual timber doesn't even end up being used as structural timber or hardwood timber. A lot of it's ended up just, you know, being used as charcoal or wood chips. To what extent is that the case? And, you know, how much of it, this is just really a waste in terms of the wood itself?
Yes, thanks for asking that question. Based on 2014 data from the Forest Products Commission, only 10% of what they log actually goes to saw logs. That's actually even further reduced in, you know, 2021, 22. But even at that time, only 10% went to saw logs and the remainder went to waste wood, charcoal for Simcoa's silicon plant, and then, not wood chips, for firewood. And I'll have to look up the exact statistics, but it's roughly one-third for each of those. And so a great deal of the firewood, it doesn't come from offcuts, but from very large mature trees which get sent to timber processors, and then they chop it up into those little blocks that you buy at the service station. Furthermore, the Forest Products Commission runs at a loss, and the taxpayers of Western Australia underwrite these guys to run a firewood business out of native hardwoods which take 150 years to recover. I would like to add one other thing which I forgot to mention in terms of their impact around the Serpentine Dam. They, under their ability to skip over various environmental acts, are able to log within what's called the reservoir protection zone of the dam. And Serpentine 03 has 75% of its area in a zone that's meant to protect a critical Perth water supply in Serpentine. If you or I go into that zone and just simply take photographs or do a nature walk or something like that, We're subject to fines of several thousand dollars. They're typically $500 for first offence. But, you know, meanwhile, the miners can go in with their drilling rigs and the loggers can go in and push through roads and everything in these very sensitive protected zones. Serpentine 03 is probably one of the better zones, but the really best is even further to the east. And there's beautiful water habitats and beautiful, extremely well-grown, lush, mature forests, which really are ecological hotspots and they could be knocked down.
It does seem quite absurd, isn't it, that you know, as you're saying, we could just get fined just for going into these areas, or if, you know, I took my dog into these areas, you can get significant fines, and yet, you know, the FPC can go in there and clear without any real regulation. Well, what is the process like at the moment, and do they have to go through any approvals, and how does the state government justify that you know, a body that's essentially running at a loss, you know, clearing this native habitat for essentially wood chips and firewood, can do so without any real regulation?
Well, I think, to be fair to the government, they have made a quite historic and dramatic move to shut down the current forest management plan and move forward to one which I think, provided we get some the public gets some input into this and the environmental organisations, will end up be one of custodianship and management of forests. But in the meantime, that forest management plan will be developed by and probably implemented by the Forest Products Commission, and their current interim committee that would advise is just full of foresters. There's no restoration ecologists on that panel or anything like this. They've also forecast to take the same amount of wood out of the forest as they did before the shutdown, under the guise of forest thinning. So there's not a great deal of transparency, and at least under the former forest management plan, which will end, they don't need to get environmental permission. They can virtually self-approve going into these blocks.
Now, before you mention the impacts of mining, and that's one thing I think that hasn't perhaps been brought up enough, that while the government might be, you know, ending or winding down the clearing of native logging, there's still a huge impact that comes from mining, particular Alcoa's bauxite mining in the Jarrah Forest, not just around Serpentine, but they, you know, spread a lot through the Swan Coastal Plain and even further south. What are the impacts of their mining? How extensive is it, and what plans do they have for expanding that mining, and, you know, therefore what impact will that have on the Jarrah in the future?
Well, that's a very good question, because despite the fact that we're protecting state forests from logging, there is no such protection from mining. And Alcoa's application to mine with the EPA is headlined as a production increase at the Pinjarra refinery. And in its introductory paragraph says that they're seeking a 5% increase in alumina production in Western Australia, and that they will be applying for some extra forest to bauxite mine in. What they didn't spell out, although the maps are there, is that the area that they've claimed, along with the already approved Larego mine to the south of Waroona, will be a 56% increase on all the mining they've ever done since 1963. And so it is a massive land grab. Now, in terms of the impact, it is far more severe than logging, because in order to get the pods of alumina, you know, the alumina pits, sorry, not alumina, bauxite pits, they have to clear fell all of the forest, remove the trees. They basically burn a lot of it that they've pushed over. There is some logging beforehand, then they burn it and then they dig it out. There's another impact also. The regrowth in those particular areas, Alcoa plants, all the previous species that were there, and they're a little bit like starting a garden. They're all starting as seedlings and plantations. And those particular, that regrowth sucks up a lot of water. It might pick up carbon, but it can't replace the carbon it knocked out. And there's studies that show that it takes about 150 years to recover the carbon by regrowth. But also the leaf area index ratio of the regrowth plants transpires a lot more water. And over the 91,000 hectares of forest that has been affected by Alcoa's mining, it's been estimated in a 2007 paper that that's equivalent to about 50 millimetres of loss of rainfall. To put that in perspective, that's about 50 gigalitres of water. If you add 20 gigalitres of water that are used in approximately, and that's a minimum estimate, in the alumina refineries, we are looking at close to 20% of Perth's water supply. Another way of imagining how much water is environmental water is lost through these operations is that's about one half of the entire Canning Swan River system each year.
And
I'll just add so that the Darling Range is heavily impacted by a drying climate in and dropping water tables, and the last thing we need is more clearing of forest to make it worse.
It does seem absurd at this point in history with our knowledge of climate change. And I guess another thing to mention, of course, is with regrowth, it takes decades and decades for that to become habitat forest. You know, there's really, for habitat hollows and so forth to fall.
Absolutely. Form, yeah. And it's quite frankly a tragedy that we've got three species of black cockatoos that are now on the endangered list. And anyone who's maybe as old as me, I'm not sure, but has seen the flocks of hundreds and hundreds of Carnaby, you know, sometimes up to 1,000 Carnaby cockatoos, 20 to 30 years ago flying through Perth and through the forest, you now see them in their dozens. They've lost their breeding hollows that and they've lost access to food. So there's actually a tragedy going on in the forest just for those animals.
Certainly. Now, Jeff, if, I guess the mining is to go ahead, if this FPC's clearing is to go ahead, and while you said before, obviously, a new forest management plan will come into effect, however, this won't impact on the mining, on Alcoa's mining operation. Well, I guess it's the question of what is to be done. I mean, really, the state government was forced to act after decades and decades of regular people campaigning and taking political action and community action. So where does that leave the local community and the surrounding community here in Perth and Western Australia in terms of protecting these forests? What can be done, and how are people starting to organise to protect these forests?
I think that's a great question, and I'd like to say there's a lot that can be done. At a very basic level, I think a large number of people have felt disempowered by all of these environmental processes and government processes. One of the first things I asked in the town of Serpentine to the lady at the shop, and this was over a year ago, I said, "What do you think about the mining up the road? What, you know, and the applications for expansion?" And she said, "Well, what can we do about it? We don't have a say. You know, the company will do what it does." We don't actually believe that. First of all, I should mention that not this Sunday, the one before, after 6 days of word of mouth around the Jarrahdale community, we said we would go and occupy the Serpentine 03 block and make a statement. And we had a modest goal for 30 people, but in turn, actually 110 people turned up, plus two horses, if you want to count them as well. And we went out and did, photo shoots and videos and all this sort of stuff. We made the front page of the Examiner paper about, with the headline title, "It's Simply Outrageous." We've also got encouraging words from the minister, but not an outright exclusion of Serpentine 03 from the block, but we are telephoning the minister's office every day with concerned people and petitioning, and we hope that the minister will listen to people and actually save the forest in their back blocks that they want to keep for their children's future. Secondly, on the mining, Alcoa, while legally not required to apply for EPA approval, have asked for EPA approval for their current expansion. One third of the forest that they've already claimed is the Larego mine, and that is actually already going ahead and did not go through EPA approval. The two new areas are going for approval in time for the renewal of their mining lease in 2024. We expect that they will make an environmental submission, the final submission, in June this year, and a number of the affected communities will be replying to the public environmental review and environmental organisations also. And we're encouraging anyone who cares to take an interest in that, and there will be help and assistance through WA Forest and Alliance, Conservation Council WA, the Wilderness Society, to help people make their own submissions. That process will go on then in review for another 18 months, possibly even 2 years, and we want to empower people to have a voice about what this is, what is actually happening. It is high time to protect these areas, and we think with small starts in Serpentine 03, we will get more and more people engaged, and we really are on about people assessing the issues for themselves and then being empowered to have a voice. And we do think change is very, very likely and possible.
Dr. Jeff Bremer there from the Jarrodale Forest Protectors. If you'd like to find out more about the group, you can head to jarrodaleforestprotectors.org. This is the Indie Media Show on RTR FM 92.1. Now, of course, all of us are watching on with bated breath as Russia has invaded Ukraine. Really quite dramatic and intense scenes from that region. The whole situation of itself is quite complex. And while, of course, here at Indie Media, like all people of conscience, we oppose all forms of militarism and empire and war. To, I guess, discuss what exactly is going on, though, we're now joined by Indie Media correspondent, co-host, co-producer, Mr. Alex Wisson. Thanks very much for joining us, Alex.
Yeah, it's good to be with you, Ray, on a very, very solemn occasion, a very dark day for humanity. And you're quite right that we'll go into some of the geopolitical minutiae and some of the detail, the strategic backdrop and what we think might be the agenda of Russia in what it's done. But first things first, we have to very plainly say that this is a naked act of criminal aggression by the Russian government. This is a full-scale invasion of an independent sovereign state, and it has absolutely shocked the world. And we can throw in all the caveats we like about NATO's eastward expansion over the course of the last 25 to 30 years, NATO's aggressive forward posturing in Eastern Europe, its installation of missile systems in Poland and the Czech Republic, as we've discussed before on the show, as well as its arming and training and supplying of the Ukrainian armed forces. So the West is hardly blameless in this situation, and there is an argument to be made that they have provoked the situation and added fuel to the fire. But those caveats aside, and it's important that we stress this again and again, this is a naked act of criminal aggression. This is a war crime by Putin's government. The Ukrainian Health Ministry has said that at least 16 children have already been killed, and there are hundreds of civilian deaths. The fog of war has very much descended over Ukraine, so it's difficult to determine the veracity of any of these claims of casualties, or indeed of the course of any of the battles that are taking place in multiple cities across the country. But that cautionary note aside, clearly the devastation is at a very large scale, and one of the aspects of what has shocked the world is just that the scale of the invasion. Many commentators, myself included, thought, well, if there was going to be an invasion, it perhaps might be limited to the southeast of the country, so-called Novorossiya or New Russia historically, Putin, listeners will know, is drawing upon history and making arguments that Ukraine, or at least parts of Ukraine, are historically associated with or even a part of the greater Russian Empire. And that's where much of the concern lies, is that the language he uses, the rhetoric he uses, is very redolent of Tsarist imperial traditions in terms of Russia's greater sphere of influence in that region. But nevertheless, there was a feeling among some commentators' analysis that if it was to be an invasion, it would be perhaps restricted to consolidating Russian control over the separatist breakaway regions of Luhansk and Donetsk. Perhaps there might be troops deployed to Odessa, which is part of this Novorossiya region, as well as in Mariupol, which is just outside of this Donbass, outside of this Donbass region. But in fact, what has happened is really just an act of sheer madness. It's hard to think of any other way to describe it, with, of course, direct assaults on the capital, Kiev, as well as a large-scale infantry and armoured columns, complemented by a combined assault of aerial and attacks from the Sea of Azov, the Russian Navy, attacking by ground, air and sea major cities throughout the country. So in the east, you have Kharkiv, which, it's worth saying as an aside, actually has a large ethnic Russian population, Russian-speaking population. So these are Russian citizens who are being bombed and attacked by Russian forces. Mariupol has come under attack, as I say, in the south. Kherson, a major city in the south. And also in the north as well, there are assaults. There are some, according to the UNHCR, the High Commissioner for Refugees, already as of yesterday, so the numbers has no doubt since gone up, 368,000, a figure worth repeating, 368,000 refugees. So that's already up to around 1% of the population. There are estimates of many, many more refugees fleeing to Poland, Romania, Moldova, Hungary, and so on. We've all seen this extraordinary, frankly hard to comprehend footage of European refugees on European soil, the kind of imagery we've not seen in many decades. Now, as another aside, some of the commentary in the Western press has been pretty ignorant, talking about this being the first war in Europe since the Second World War. That's not true. We can take hours actually to go through all the wars that have taken place in Europe. War in Northern Ireland, Turkish invasion of Cyprus, the Basque Separatist War, the ETA War in Spain, the Greek Civil War after the Second World War, the Armenian-Azerbaijan War. We could go on, but probably the relevant point of comparison, and it might give us some idea of what Russia's strategic ambitions are here, is, and it's strange this has hardly been mentioned in the Western press, is, of course, the Russo-Georgian War of 2008, which might be seen as a precursor or an early iteration of the same playbook that Russia is now playing out in Ukraine, where if you look at what happened there 14 years ago, the Russians supported a breakaway region in Georgia, the south Ossetia, which had in fact declared its independence in the immediate post-Soviet period in 1991. This was always a kind of a stalking horse for Russia within Georgian territory through a series of contrivances and clashes between the Georgian armed forces and the South Ossetians. Russia sought to intervene, and it actually did attack major Georgian cities, including Tbilisi itself, as well as major ports, airports, military installations, and briefly occupied several major cities in Georgia. Then, after a 12-day conflict, actually withdrew their forces and consolidated control over this breakaway region of Georgia. So this is, of course, one of the big questions, is nobody knows what Putin wants to do. There's a lot of really kind of hysterical commentary around that in the press, but to be quite frank, on that score at least, we can understand it, we can agree with it, that Putin is, you can't say that he's a madman per se. There may be some kind of geostrategic foreign policy logic to this, but it's very difficult to see what it is. It's very difficult indeed to see what it is, whether this is leading to an occupation regime, a brief period of occupation and then strategic retreat to then basically force NATO's hand, to force NATO to concede that Ukraine is back in Russia's sphere of influence. We don't know. And war has its own force of gravity. That's something that's worth saying as well, that just as war is a continuation of politics by other means, politics is a continuation of war by other means. And there's a kind of a messy interplay that happens where, in fact, the political objectives that you are seeking to meet through the agency of war, that's not necessarily a clean and easy, straightforward pathway, anything but. War itself has its own logic, and matters have perhaps arguably now got out of control, even of Putin. And so it's very, very difficult to say where this will go next, but it is not, I think that the path of diplomacy or of stepping back from the brink is very clearly not on the cards in the next few days, and we're facing a very dark situation that has implications so profound and so long-term for really the whole of humanity that one cannot even begin to ascertain what those repercussions might be at this stage. But we're heading into a dark period of history. We're heading into a new era of international relations, one marked by war and hostility. And this is just the very beginning of a much greater conflict, which eventually will involve really the tussle or the struggle as to who controls the political economy of the globe. And that's not me being melodramatic. That is the reality of the situation. This is, I think, the opening gambit of a much wider conflict between Russia and China and potentially India on one hand. It's worth noting India abstained in the Security Council with a vote to condemn Russia. So it's not only China that is Russia's ally. A number of emerging powers on the one, lining up with Russia on the one hand and the traditional NATO alliance led by the United States on the other. And really a 10-year-old child could see where that is heading in terms of those blocks of nations, those two military alliances lining up against each other. And there's so much to say around this, Ray. We probably only have very limited time, I'm sure. But, I mean, there is so many hostilities ratcheting up on both sides. One very significant development is the German Chancellor Olaf Scholz in an extraordinary speech. I saw all of it. One can't stress enough the significance of his speech, where he has committed Germany to spending 100 billion euros a year in the military, going beyond what it has spent in the past, unashamedly and openly saying that Germany, for heaven's sake, is adopting an aggressive military stance against Russia. So you can see with those kinds of announcements and the deployments of NATO forces to Russia's western flank, NATO's eastern flank, that this is setting the tone, if you like, setting the pieces on the geopolitical chessboard, as I say, for many years, if not decades to come.
Alex Wisson, just before we let you go, I mean, for a lot of people being here in Perth, it's distressing to look on and not know what to do. And I guess, there are places, aid organisations and so forth that people can donate to. But at the centre of this is we really have a total absolute lack of an anti-war movement in this country. While there have been some solidarity demonstrations called for the people of Ukraine, it really, this whole situation has spoken to the total absence of an anti-war movement here in Australia. Do you think that it might potentially at least, though, spark the beginnings of a return to an anti-war movement, a peace movement here? And, in that sort of that age-old question, what is to be done? What can we do here in lonely old Perth to bring about some sort of, anti-war movement and movement for justice?
No, I don't think there's any possibility of a revitalisation of the anti-war movement in Australia for a number of reasons, and the chief among them being the sclerotic, weak, strategically rudderless nature of the left in this country. And that's, a whole other separate topic of conversation. So the left is so weak and so rudderless that, no, there'll be no revitalisation at all of an anti-war movement. I think that's a foolish hope to imagine there will be. So I think it does come back. What I will say, actually, and I am as guilty of this as the next person on the left, I think there's something altogether inappropriate about concentrating for now, at this very moment, at this moment of great human need and desperation and suffering, to focus on the kind of disputes among the left. There's a question of what we should do, and that to me, the question is one of basic human solidarity. So we can leave aside the more complex questions, the kind of difficult questions of what is US's role in this, to what extent do we support Ukraine, which is a puppet of the Americans, and so on. Because let's be clear about that. We can talk about the suffering of the Ukrainian people, but solidarity with the Ukrainian government, a corrupt puppet regime of the West, is another thing altogether. We can discuss the nature of the Putin regime. There's all kinds of questions we can discuss in terms of the political aspects of this, but there is human suffering taking place, and that's what we ought to keep in the forefront of our mind. Now, what form does solidarity then practically take? I don't have the immediate answer to that question. I think it would be extremely arrogant of me to pretend that I did, and arrogant of anyone else to pretend they did. Donations, charity, to be quite honest, that might be the thing to do for now. It's not to say that I'm opposed to trying to have anti-war marches, but frankly, I don't see that there's a much possibility of that really happening in any meaningful meaningful way in this country. So in many ways, we are left to sit on the sides. What we can concentrate on is condemning Scott Morrison's efforts to add fuel to the fire. You're talking about assisting the Ukrainian government with lethal aid. What form that takes and the scale of that assistance, we don't know yet. So I think that's what we have to kind of concentrate on, is Australia should not be party to actually adding to the conflagration of this incredibly dangerous war, because adding fuel to the fire is only going to make it worse. And I think we need to avoid this kind of simple but seductive binaries of Ukraine equals freedom, democracy, Russia equals evil tyranny. It's not even close to being that simple, and it's important that we don't fall into that trap. So by all means, I support all efforts to build an anti-war movement, but maybe more basic, practical, immediate solidarity in the form of whatever aid you can think of might be the thing to focus on for now.
Indie Media's Alex Wisson speaking to us about the unfolding conflict and war in the Ukraine. Thanks very much for joining us, Alex.
That's okay.